think we're just about all here, so let us. Okay. Let me pick the tar on notes. So, okay, so on the schedule, the revised schedule, if you looked at it, it was November. For some reason, I got November all fouled up the first time I did this, and I had noticed one of them, but I had not noticed a second mistake. So today we're doing Chapter 6, October 30th. Next week, Chapter 7. The week after, Chapter 8. November 20th, chapters 9 and 10. And I had left out November 27th completely, and a lot of people thought I was going to celebrate American Thanksgiving.
Yeah. Good so, idea.
Anyway, that's chapter 11. And then we'll do, on the 4th of December, the last class of the semester, we may fall behind, and this gives us a little leeway to fall behind if we feel like falling behind. And so we'll catch up and we'll have a discussion on that class, the 4th of December. Okay, so that's, that now is the schedule, and that's the appropriate one. So if you look, first of all, at the page on the transition from chapters 1 to 5 to chapters 6 and 7, and also an overview of chapters 6 and 7, this will kind of set us before we launch into chapter 6 to sort of locate us and orient us as to just exactly where we are. Lonergan is studying the act of understanding. And he studies the act of understanding in chapters 1 to 5 as insight is into things as they are related to one another. Scientific insight particularly, and especially in mathematics and physics. Chapters 6 and 7, he switches completely to a whole other realm in which insight functions in human living, and that's the everyday living. Insight in everyday living. Insight into the relations of things to us. Things here considered as very broadly. Just it means people, it means situations, it means jobs, it means things to do, and all of that sort of thing. The things that we deal with in our everyday lives. And the insight into that, into our relations with one another, into our work, into our into politics, into economics, into the political system, into who to vote for the next mayor of Toronto, all of those things. This is common sense insight into the relations of things to us. In either case, his emphasis is on insight. It's not on the relations themselves. So he's not concerned in the first five chapters with giving you the physics. But rather, he's talking about how insight functions in science. But he's not giving it. That's obviously, it's not a book like Lindsay and Margano's Foundations of Physics, which is one that, a book that he refers to occasionally for examples. But it's not, the first five chapters are not a text in physics. They're rather an exploration of the act of insight. And so in these two chapters, chapters 6 and 7, the chapters on common sense, he's not focusing on anything more than the act of insight alone, this time as it functions in everyday human affairs. So I quoted there from the end of chapter 7, page 268 at the top of the page, within the perspectives of the present work, there is no point to a full and accurate account of the fields of psychology and of sociology. So chapter 6 is not a psychology. Chapter 7 is not a sociology or an economics or a political theory. The topic, rather, is insight, understanding. To exhibit its nature and its implications, one has to venture into every department in which human intelligence plays a significant role. Still, that venture is essentially a limited venture, for it is enough for our purpose to show that the notion of insight is indispensable in an adequate view. In other words, you can't skip accounting. When you're accounting for psychopathology, insight is something that must be brought into account. But he's in no way is he claiming to give a full account of psychopathology or psychotherapy in chapter 6. nor is he attempting in any case to give any kind of a full economic or political theory in Chapter 7. He's simply saying that insight functions in these areas, and he's studying that and that alone. So to show that the notion of insight is indispensable in an adequate view, that it explains both the high esteem in which common sense is commonly held and the limitations to which it is subject. And that's a big emphasis, particularly in Chapter 7. Common sense alone cannot handle social problems. We need more than common sense. This explanation can begin from independent and apparently disparate premises, and within the larger context that they yield, succeed in hitting off the thought of the average person, the problem of his or her affects, and the dialectic of his or her history. So it's only to demonstrate the role of understanding in these fields. That's all that he's concerned with. And so we have to be careful that we don't. For instance, he'll say much later on in the book that a study of human relationships is extremely important, but he thinks it's best carried out in theology rather than in philosophy. So he's pointing in that direction towards the end of the book. So he's not giving in Chapter 6 by any means an attempt. He's not attempting to account fully for the realm of psychopathology or psychotherapy. Still, in each case, the study of insight opens upon the presentation of the heuristic structure within which more particular departments of human knowledge find their place. And so the first five chapters do culminate in the presentation of a worldview, emergent probability, as the formal intelligibility of a universe known by the natural sciences. And then in Chapter 6, the view of concrete extensions and durations as the potency or field for such an emergent probability. So he's suggesting something here in terms of a worldview. And the same thing will be true with Chapters 6 and 7. Precisely by focusing on insight as it functions or fails to function in everyday life, at the same time he is offering elements of a heuristic structure for the human sciences. But in no way is he attempting to give a full psychology or a full sociology. Thus, how does this play out in these two chapters? Chapter 6 offers elements of a heuristic structure for studying the changes brought about in us through the development and decline of our patterned capacity to understand things and their relations to us. Now, every word there, this is like Waterman at this point, every word is important, okay? Studying the changes that are brought about in you and me as our capacity, our patterned capacity to understand things in their relations to us develops or declines. So as I become more capable of understanding things that for whatever reason previously in my life I couldn't understand, changes take place in me. As I become capable of understanding other people's relations to me, which perhaps for some reason I was not able to understand earlier, or couldn't even deal with, a change takes place in me. Or as I fail to understand, or as I can't deal with, for whatever reason, psychic trauma, or I can't deal with certain things in my life, there's a decline that takes place in my own development. There's an arrest to my personal development. So the changes that are brought about in us through the development and decline of our patterned capacity to understand things and their relations to us, and especially in that pattern of experience that he calls the dramatic pattern in which we live our everyday lives in companionship and interchange with others. In this pattern, our desire is so to be engaged in the drama of living that individually we forge a work of art out of our own lives, and communally we forge a work of art out of our common world. That is our setting, that's our desire. Our desire is to make of our lives and our world a work of art, together with others, a work of dramatic artistry. And the role of insight in that task, in that project, in fulfilling that desire, is what he's focusing on. And we become capable at certain points in our lives of breakthroughs in insight into relations, situations, perhaps past hurt and trauma, and so on and so forth. We become capable of insight into those, insight that previously we were not able to entertain. And as that happens, there's a change that takes place in us. So it's studying the effect of the inability to understand and then the ability to understand certain things in our lives as they impinge upon us, the changes brought about in us as we understand or fail to understand things in their relations to us. And the point, the essential point in that whole development in chapter 6 is in this next paragraph. By the time we become capable of exercising critical reflection and responsible deliberation, we talk about the age of 7 as the age of reason, okay, whatever it is, but by the time a person becomes capable of exercising critical reflection and responsible deliberation, the capacity to understand things in their dramatic relations to us has already begun to be patterned by the changes that have been brought about in us independently of our conscious reflection and choice. Okay? We are born into a certain family. That family has been affected by economic, political, personal, and so on, a whole history. We're born into that family, and our capacity to understand things in their relations to us is already patterned by that background. That patterning affects our very capacity to admit into consciousness the psychic representations of neural process that are the images required for insight. So there's a patterning that takes place early on in our lives. It begins from the very beginning of our lives. A patterning of our spontaneous and unreflective orientation in life by the relations of other people to us. And that patterning continues throughout our lives, but changes can be introduced into it as we develop or decline as artists in the drama of human living. Now, the bulk of chapter 6 is devoted to those changes in us at the level of psychic spontaneity, and especially to the role of the neglect, first of all, the neglect of insight in bringing about personal collapse, and secondly, the positive role of insight in the healing of such spontaneity, provided that insight occurs in the dramatic pattern of experience. If it's just an intellectual insight, it doesn't do anything at all. If it occurs in the dramatic pattern of experience, it's going to have some effect. So the pattern's capacity to admit images for insight into consciousness is what Lonergan, how Lonergan understands what Freud meant when he spoke of a sensor. A sensor that operates prior to reflection and deliberation in admitting certain images and their concomitant affects into consciousness and in repressing other images and diverting their affective complements to other cognitive or apprehensive elements. We'll see this in detail. I'm just trying to set up what's coming here and what he's talking about. There is our orientation that is patterned for us independently of our choice. Early on in life, all right, functions as a sensor that allows certain things into consciousness in the form of images and affects and screens other things out. The basic function of the sensor in a person who develops without a lot of difficulty and harm and trauma in his or her life, the basic function of the sensor is positive, to screen out what's irrelevant, so that people can focus on the relevant. But that orientation is easily distorted, and I dare say for all of us, to a certain extent, has been distorted by factors that are beyond our control, so that we do end up screening out at times what's relevant and admitting into consciousness what is irrelevant and incongruous. In that context, the basic function of psychotherapy entails transforming the sensor from a repressive functioning to a constructive functioning in one's living. In my own work, that is what I mean by psychic conversion. I've spoken about psychic conversion. I've added a psychic conversion to Lonergan's intellectual, moral, and religious conversion. And what I mean by that is the transformation of the sensor from a repressive functioning to a constructive functioning in one's living, so that I no longer am unconsciously and unwittingly keeping out what I need for to get on with my life. In the sense of images and the concomitant effects. Now, Lonergan would want to maintain that the healing always involves insight. He's not saying that it's insight is the principal thing. And in my own development, I have said, and I had an email from one of you this last week, that love is the principal thing, and I've said that as well in my own work. But that insight is involved, and that love is what frees up insight. Love is what frees up the capacity to allow into consciousness the images that I need for insight into my life. And that's all he's saying, is that insight's involved. He's not saying it's the central thing, but that it is important, as cognitive therapists would also insist. So there's a whole school of cognitive therapy. I was just on the board of a dissertation in the DMIN program where someone was working with Lonergan and Aaron Beck, therapist, and showing the correlations between the thinking. And all he's saying is that insight's involved. He's not saying that it's the central thing or the main cause or anything like that, just that there is a functional correlation. And Herbert Fingeret is somebody that I heard Lonergan appeal to. I don't know whether he's ever quoted him in his writing, but Fingeret describes neurosis as always entailing cumulatively misinterpreted experience. And so part of the healing of neurosis is to turn the misinterpretation into an accurate interpretation. And that's what Lonergan's getting at when he speaks about insight. So he's not saying insight is the only or even the most important element. He's prescinding from causal relations and positing only a functional correlation. He's concerned only to place insight on the therapeutic map. The unconscious flight from understanding that is dramatic bias, and we'll see this in all in detail here, but I'm just trying to set the context, is one factor in the development of psychic difficulties. And the recovery of insight that previously had been inhibited is one factor in the therapeutic process. So that's the main brunt of chapter 6. And chapter 7, just to look ahead for a week, chapter 6 focuses on the changes in us that are brought about because other things, people, situations, work, whatever, are related to us. Chapter 7 focuses on the changes in other things that are brought about because we are related to them. We make decisions, and we affect changes. We affect changes in our institutions. We affect changes in our technological, economic, and political institutions and structures and so on. So changes are introduced into our world. That's what he's studying in chapter 7. By our recurrent interventions of common sense insight. We grasp a situation, we say, well, if we did this, it could be better. We do it, we improve the situation, and so on and so forth. Common sense insight functions not only in a dramatic pattern of personal living, but also in a practical pattern that is concerned with getting things done in the most effective manner. So we bring about technological developments, we establish economic systems, we create political orders through the recurrent interventions of practical common sense in the organization of human living. Chapter 7 then studies the role of insight in these changes of social structure and cultural mentality. And in doing so, it tries to bring to light other instances of the flight from understanding. There's a dramatic bias that is beyond our control in personal living if we have been severely traumatized, for instance, as a young child. It's beyond our control and it needs to be healed. But there are other biases that are much more within our control. They affect how we change the world. And he studies the individual bias of the egoist, the group bias of class and gender and so on, and then the general bias of common sense against all long-term and ultimate issues and questions. So So there's, in addition to the dramatic bias, there are these other biases that are more conscious and often much more under our control than the dramatic bias that we study in chapter 6. So that's just to give you to set up where we're moving from here. Any questions just on the general orientation? The details we will take as we move into chapter 6. Okay, so then we move to the books on chapter 6. Chapter 6 then moves to the study of insight in everyday life. Insight in everyday life is what Lonergan means by common sense. Common sense is, one way of talking about common sense, I didn't put this in the notes, is the everyday level of cultural meanings and values in our own milieu. And there are many different instances of common sense. If you've traveled in Europe by train, you can see 6 or 7 instances of common sense in the course of a given day as you go through one small country after another. I've mentioned before that the major difference in common sense that I've noticed is crossing the border from Switzerland to Italy. It's just a totally different way of doing things. And it's palpable, it's noticeable. It's just a different way of relating, a different way of doing, setting up structures and everything. It's just, neither one is better than the other, they're just different. There are different ways of everyday interaction. So there are different common senses for different cultures. So he moves it then to the study of insight in everyday life, and that's what he means by common sense. And I quoted this material in chapter from the end of chapter 7 in the transition, but it was interesting to us as we were editing the book to notice in one of his earlier manuscripts on this chapter how he put that, the hitting off the thought of the average person, the problem of his or her affects, and so on. And earlier, he had some examples of people that he was dealing with, that he was thinking of as he was writing these chapters, and I think it's interesting to just see what they were. Hitting off the thought of the average person, as would Newman, the problem of his or her affects, as would Freud, and the dialectic of his or her history, as would a higher synthesis of liberal and Marxist thought. So that gives some insight into what was the context that he was dealing with. The Freudian context is obvious, but it's the particularly the Newman context is not as obvious from reading the chapters. Freud and Marx are mentioned quite frequently in the two chapters, but Newman is not. Anyway, the spirit of inquiry, the desire to know, is a native endowment of human beings. And it manifests itself not only in science, but in everyday living. It manifests itself in the child, in this very small child, who is asking one question after another. Spontaneous inquiry. And in the spontaneous accumulation of related insights, and in the spontaneous process of learning. And it is these three together, spontaneous inquiry, what is this, what is that, why do they do this, so on and so forth, the spontaneous accumulation of related insights and the spontaneous process of learning, including self-correcting process of learning, these three together, as they function in a community, yield the notion of common sense as an intellectual development. So whatever community, we come from different communities, even in this group, different cultural communities, and different instances of common sense, which is a common development of everyday meanings and values concerned with the interactions, interrelations of people and how to get things done and so on and so forth. So we are born into a community. The community might be Canadian, it might be American, it might be Australian, it might be Maltese, it might be Malaysian, whatever. We are born into a community that possesses a common fund of tested answers. From that fund, each may draw one's variable share, measured by one's capacity, one's interests, and one's energy. So we pick up, as we grow in this community, we pick up certain shared meanings and values, shared insights into how to live. Not only does the self-correcting process of learning unfold within the private consciousness of the individual, for by speech, and still more by example, there is effected a sustained communication that at once disseminates and tests and improves every advance to make the achievement of each successive generation the starting point of the next. So common sense develops slowly but surely over time. So it's this common fund of meanings and values based on insights into how to do things, how to relate to other people, how to set up families and institutions and structures and so on that is meant by common sense. Common sense differs very markedly from scientific knowledge. It is a specialization in the particular and the concrete. Everybody's got some common sense. Very good common sense, but we've all got some specialization in the particular and the concrete. It's common, but not general. It consists in a set of insights. This is now as it's common, okay? A set of insights that remains incomplete until there is added further insight into the situation in hand, okay? So there's a tested fund. Nobody is able to do an inventory of the whole thing, okay? But there's a certain unspoken understanding that is common among people in the same society. That is just it's a result of a whole accumulated tradition of how to interact, how to do things, and so on. But it's incomplete. And as new situations come along, there are new insights that are needed into dealing with that situation. But once that situation has passed, the added insight is no longer relevant. So the common sense of the group reverts to its previous incompleteness. It's enough to get by, but we know that as we deal with new things, we've got to have new insights. But once they're passed, okay, that's over. We'll go back to our ordinary way of living. Its analogies are not logically formulated. So this situation like that one and so on, but it's not a logical formulation of analogy. In correspondence with the similarities of situations, it appeals to an incomplete set of insights. When in Rome, do as the Romans do, okay? And, so you just follow what they're doing there. But in correspondence with the differences in situations, it adds the different relevant insights. Its generalizations are not premises for deductions, but just pointers that it is well to keep in mind, as in Proverbs. And those generalizations, if you were a logician, you'd find that they contradict each other. A stitch in time saves nine, but he who leaps is lost, or something like that. I mean, if you say you get the point that I'm saying. And if you took those as logical premises, you'd say, well, you're caught in a logical contradiction. But nobody takes them that way. They're just helpful things to have in mind to help you get through situations. Common sense does not aspire to universally valid knowledge and does not attempt exhaustive communication. It is out only to negotiate each situation as it arises, by adding a relevant set of insights to its accumulated store. It doesn't try to formulate its incomplete insights in definitions and postulates or in a systematic fashion. If anybody tried to do that, he or she would be regarded as quite odd. It doesn't employ a technical language or a formal mode of speech. Its expressions are nuanced, depending on the exigencies of concrete communication. They are a work of art, not a formal logic. Draw on tone of voice, volume, facial expression, gestures, pauses, as well as on language. A wink is as good as a nod. You know? Sometimes the communication can take place much more through a little smile than through a logical disposition. It follows no general rules. And it will be different in different cultures. The same gesture will have a different careful about your gestures or your various things. So too, it envisages a different plane of reality from that of science. The plane of reality is things that are related to us. Without the ulterior purpose of theory, that is found in scientific description. It restricts further questions to the concrete and the particular, the immediate and the practical. And a person who is a person only of common sense will brush aside as totally irrelevant all other questions. Anyone who raises those other questions is just an ivory tower egghead. Okay? The supreme canon of common sense is the restriction of further questions to the realm of the concrete and the particular, the immediate and the practical. The advance in common sense is to restrain the omnivorous drive of inquiring intelligence, and to brush aside as irrelevant, if not silly, any question whose answer would not make an immediately palpable difference. So, that's the restriction, that's the specialization. Still, this is the sanity, I think, of the position that he's presenting here. Common sense is complementary to science. It's different from science, but he's not saying science is true and common sense is false. He's not saying that. For one thing, scientists need common sense to apply methods properly in executing the concrete tasks of particular investigations, just as logicians need common sense if they are to grasp what is meant in each concrete act of human utterance. And in general, it has been argued up to this point in the book, in the first five chapters, that there exists a complementarity between classical and statistical investigations. Perhaps now, he says, it is evident that the whole of science, with logic thrown in, is a development of intelligence that is complementary to the development named common sense. Rational choice is not between science and common sense, it's a choice of both. Of science to master the universal, the theoretical, relations of things to one another, common sense to deal with the particular, the concrete relations of things to us. And finally, in this first section about the general notion of common sense is divided into specialized departments or brands determined by place, occupation, social arrangements, and so on. Students have common sense that professors don't have. Professors have a common sense understanding of students. Workers and managers and owners and so on, different brands of common sense depending on their social arrangements. And at once, it adapts individuals in every walk of life to the work they have chosen or the lot that has befallen them. And no less, it generates all those minute differences of viewpoint and mentality that separate men and women, old and young, town and country, until in the limit, one reaches the cumulative differences and mutual incomprehension of different strata of society, different nations, different civilizations, and different epochs of human history. So there are as many instances of common sense as there are common sets of meanings and values, just as there are as many cultures as there are common sets of meanings and values informing given ways of living. Okay? But it's all this has to do with how we negotiate our relations with one another and the practical tasks of everyday life. That's what it's all about. That's what comes. The bulk of the chapter is concerned with you and me as the subjects to whom the objects of common sense are related. The objects, the things as related to us. The subjects who are related also to those objects. So the bulk of the chapter is us as subjects. Who are we? Who am I? Who are you? Do we not change? Is not the acquisition of common sense itself a change in us? It changes the subjective term in the object-to-subject relations that it knows. And in chapter 7, we will see that it also changes the object term, the objects to which we are related. To understand the subjective developments, Lonergan begins with the notion of patterns of experience. This will be a notion that will carry through the entire book. And later on in his work, it will go over into and feed into his notion of differentiation of consciousness. So in this book, he speaks, in this chapter, he speaks of a biological pattern of experience, an aesthetic pattern of experience, an intellectual pattern of experience, and a dramatic pattern of experience. In the next chapter, he'll speak of a practical pattern of experience. And later on in the book, he will speak of a mystical pattern. When he talks about differentiations of consciousness, in his later work, in addition to common sense, there is theory, which would correspond to the intellectual pattern of experience. There is art, which corresponds to the aesthetic pattern of experience. There is interiority, or the philosophic differentiation, or interiorly differentiated consciousness, which basically corresponds to what he's doing. All of his work, differentiating interiority. Let's see, theory, art, there's the transcendence, or the religious differentiation of consciousness, which would correspond to the mystical pattern of experience. There's common sense itself, which corresponds to, in this book, the practical and the dramatic patterns of experience. So there are overlaps between his early talking of patterns of experience and in his later work, like Method and Theology, speaking of various differentiations of consciousness. What is a pattern of experience? A pattern of experience, number 9, is a particular ordering of elements that occur at the first level of consciousness. Remember now that we've got levels of consciousness, experience and understanding, and then judgment and decision. We're still dealing with these two, experience and understanding. By various elements that occur at the empirical level of consciousness, or the level, if you want, of the sensitive psyche, okay? It's the stream of sensations, images, memories, associations, strivings or conations is the word that he uses, and conscious bodily movements. A sequence of sensations, images, memories, emotions. Like an emotions, you might know. Emotions. Conscious bodily movement, spontaneous intersubjective responses. Particular ordering. These elements of experience now, our sensations, our memories, our images, our emotions, and so on, take on different orderings depending on our interests, our purposes, our direction. Right? They're ordered in one way. If, for instance, we are in an aesthetic pattern of experience, if our interest is the aesthetic appreciation of beauty or the aesthetic creation of a work of art, then there's going to be a particular order to our sensations, memories, images, affects, and everything else oriented towards that aesthetic experience. If we're Isaac Newton in his room for 3 weeks figuring out the laws of motion and so on, everything fits into that intellectual pattern of experience. All the his sensations, images, memories, and so on, they're all feeding that desire to know, that desire for insight, and so on. So there are particular orderings of the sequence of sensations, memories, images, emotions, conscious bodily movements, determined by different interests, different purposes, different directions. Pattern of experience is defined on 206 as a set of intelligible relations that link together sequences of sensations, memories, images, conations, emotions, and bodily movements. Sensations, acts of seeing, hearing, touching, tasting, smelling, do not occur in isolation from one another or from other events. Not only do they have a bodily base, not only are they functionally related to bodily movements, but they also may occur in some dynamic context that unifies a manifold of sensed contents and of acts of sensing. But above all, they're organized by the direction of the stream. And that organization is what makes for a pattern of experience. Pattern, the intelligible relations that link the elements together. The only way, the best way to get at this is in terms of taking the examples of the four that he talks about. So number 10, there's a biological pattern. If you have ever been in a situation where you were threatened with imminent danger to your life, or where you are starving and there is no hope that you can see for getting food, or you're thirsting and you're out in the desert or whatever, and there's no water around, you go into the biological pattern of experience. All of your sensations and your feelings. I saw the movie with Matt Damon and Casey Affleck out in the middle of the desert. What was that movie?
Jerry.
Everything is, by the once they realized that they were stuck and they were lost in the desert, it's pure biological pattern of experience. Everything's converging on self-preservation. All of their images, all of their sensations, their memories, their emotions, their efforts, their conations are focused on self-preservation. Consciousness in the biological pattern is extroverted. It's concerned with the external conditions and opportunities of living. It's confrontational. It's looking for what is going to give life, self-preservation. Human consciousness slips into the biological pattern under conditions of danger, hunger, thirst, and so on. Conation, emotion, and bodily movement are a response to stimulus. The stimulus is over against the response. It's a presentation through sense and memory and imagination of what is responded to, of what is to be dealt with. The stimulating elements are an elementary object. The responding elements are the elementary subject. Now, this extroversion and confrontation in our earliest days, conscious days, in infancy, we are by and large in a biological pattern. And there is an extroversion and a confrontation, the confrontational elements that become fixed in our consciousness at that time. And these things can perdure in our dramatic living, and to a certain extent must perdure. They can also perdure well into cognitional theory. And in that particular area, they can cause difficulty if we still have the idea that the real is the out there to be known by confrontation, by taking a look at it. In other words, there are patterns that are biological that can be carried over into philosophical positions and cause tremendous difficulty because they're not nuanced and there isn't the sufficient development that can take place. This we'll see, this will come back later. That the criteria of the real in the biological pattern of experience can become the criteria of the real in one's philosophy, and then one's philosophy is in trouble. One might be very well able to deal with issues of self-preservation, but probably can't get on with the next step in epistemology. The real is only the already out there now responding to biological exigencies. No, that's not the only pattern that human beings live in. And in fact, with many animals, it would seem that it's not just the biological pattern. Animals play. And dogs and cats, one of the reasons that they make such good pets is that you can play with them. And they move out of the biological pattern and into this something of an elementary aesthetic pattern, where experience is liberated from biological purposes. Experience can occur just for the sake of experiencing. that liberation is a spontaneous and self-justifying joy. It's wonderful when you're in it, and you're just enjoying being alive. And topics in education, Lonergan links art with non-instrumentalized experience. The artist is a specialist in the aesthetic pattern. The artist discovers ever novel forms to unify and relate the contents and acts of such experience. Art is a twofold freedom. It liberates intelligence from the wearying constraints of mathematical proofs, scientific verifications, common sense naturalness, as well as liberating our consciousness from pure biological exigence. Art embodies insights. Embodies them. It doesn't express them in concepts. It embodies them in colors, in shapes, in sounds, in movements, in the situations and actions of fiction. Lonergan's later definition, based on Suzanne Langer, of art: art is the objectification of a purely experiential pattern, where experience is allowed to occur for its own sake, and then is expressed and objectified, whether it be in color, or in sound, or in dance, or movement. Or art seeks to convey something that can be reached through participation, through a reenactment in some fashion of the artist's inspiration and intention. Art obscurely symbolizes the deep-set wonder in its elemental sweep, and the possible answers to the questions we are for ourselves. And it does that not by logical demonstration, but by communicating moods, moods in which questions arise, tones in which they may be answered or ignored. Music does that. Painting can do that. It's not all of it, but it's part of it. But it's a completely different sequence of sensations, memories, images, emotions, and so on, from the biological, where everything is focused on self-preservation. And in art, it's in the aesthetic pattern, whether we're enjoying or creating, there is an element of non-instrumentalized experience, where experience is simply allowed to exist and function as it is, for its own sake. Next, the intellectual pattern of experience. When you're studying theology, frequently you have to go into this. If you're studying mathematics or science, you have to be in it all the time. Art and aesthetic experience generate in our experience, in our flow of sensations and memories and images and so on, flexibility. We have a flexibility, and that flexibility makes of our empirical flow of consciousness a ready tool also of the spirit of inquiry that dominates the intellectual pattern. In the intellectual pattern of experience, sensitive process cooperates in many ways with intellectual desire. And this is the quotation from page 209. In the seasoned mathematician, sensitive process easily contracts to an unruffled sequence of symbolic notations and schematic images. That's what they see. That's what they attend to. In the trained observer, outer sense forgets its primitive biological functions to take on a selective alertness that keeps pace with the refinements of elaborate and subtle classifications. The example that Lonergan frequently gives the entomologist who sees things in a bug that I don't see. I just see a bug. Entomologist sees all sorts of things. Sensitive process taking on a selective alertness in keeping with the purpose of trying to understand, in this case, a bug. In the theorist intent upon a problem, even the subconscious goes to work to yield in unexpected moments the suggestive images of clues and missing links. Kekulé's dream of the snake eating its tail, which gave him the image for the benzene ring. Subconscious going to work, creating these images, patterns, perspectives that give rise to the insight that one is seeking. Again, in reflection now moving to judgment, In intellectual reflection, there arises a passionless calm. Memory ferrets out instances that would run counter to the prospective judgment. Imagination anticipates the shape of possibilities that would prove the judgment wrong. What about this? So deep is the penetration, so firm the dominance, so strange the transformation of sensitive spontaneity, that memories and anticipations rise above the threshold of consciousness only if they possess at least a plausible relevance to the decision to be made. For the stream of sensitive experience, this is the big thing that he's trying to get at here, is a chameleon. And as its pattern can be biological or artistic, so too it can become the automatic instrument, or rather the vitally adaptive collaborator of the spirit of the empire. Even with that cooperation, one takes years to learn a field thoroughly enough that one can set out on one's own. So that's again in the intellectual pattern of experience. And I want to add here, RD means me. RD is common commentary. It seems clear to me now in these instances that the level of experience is more than sensations, emotions, images, memories, and so on and so forth. There's a link here also to the received meanings and values that allow for a connection of Lonergan to Heidegger and Wittgenstein. I'll say more about that as we go along. I think we have to expand the notion of the first level of consciousness to include received meanings and values that come into our consciousness because we are living in a given social milieu and things are passed on to us. So there's a public meaning to a lot of language, and that's what Wittgenstein and Heidegger will speak of Verstehen, and Heidegger's Verstehen, I think, is an operation of a transaction with this empirical level of consciousness. Anyway, that's a technical point. All right, and that point will be even more the case with the thematic pattern, where I think meanings and values function as well as these other materials. We can stop at this point for a break and we'll come back and move into the meeting. Is there a question before we go?
A definition of conations?
Strivings. I think it's like sort of elemental orientations. Would be like in the biological pattern, if you're threatened with danger, the sensitive orientation is to get out of it. That would be a conation.
Like a reflex.
Reflex, yes. Reflex, directed reflex.
When you say meanings and values as part of the experience, would that be basically the common sense?
Well, see, what I think is that our empirical consciousness is not that. A non-rational animal. It's more than that. So that there comes into our field of receptive. I want to call the first level of consciousness now the level of reception. And we receive not only colors and sounds and the data of sense from outside, but also we receive certain elements that are already invested. That things as they come into our consciousness are not only sensitively patterned, they can also be intellectually patterned by the culture that we grow up in. So Wittgenstein's notion I think Wittgenstein makes this too exclusive, that language is always public in its meaning and only derivatively private. Well, I think that's true of ordinary loudness. Makes the distinction between ordinary meaningfulness and original meaningfulness. If a person's got a new insight, they are creating language to express that insight. They have to create it if it's an original insight. And original insights occur, but if people are going to communicate original insights, they must create a language to communicate that. So there is a new language that comes with original insight. So that's the language that follows upon understanding, inner word and outer word. Okay, there's a new language. But we, by the time you're 2 years old, there's a whole world of meanings that has been given to you, right? that you've received, but you have not submitted to inquiry yet. You haven't submitted it to criticism. You haven't submitted it to, you must, in the course of your, you must submit your cultural tradition, your religious tradition, and so on, to criticism if you're going to make it your own. You've got to do that. But you can't do it when you're 2 years old. And there's a whole load of things that we take in that are also filled with meaning and with value, you know, that are really taken in at a receptive level, and it's closer to the empirical level. They all work together.
I guess where I get confused is it seems like to receive a meaning and a value presupposes an insight, that you've acknowledged it, that as meaning.
It presupposes, it does, there is an understanding, but it's an it's not, the way I put it in the stuff that I've written over the course of the last year is that Lonergan's, Heidegger's Verstehen is not Lonergan's insight. Okay? They're both understanding, but they're different types of action.
It's like a rudimentary.
It's a rudimentary understanding.
Like a mimetic kind of understanding.
Pardon me?
Like a mimetic kind of understanding. You just pick it up because that's what they do.
That's right. But it is understanding. It's not just sensation. There's understanding. I think we have to say that. And I think this opens up the possibility of interchange and dialogue between Lonergan and Wittgenstein and Heidegger both, which is one of the reasons that I'm trying to pursue this.
That seems to be what Lonergan suggests on the quote you have in paragraph 3198 of community that possesses a common fund of tested answers.
There are. I'm finding clues for this now. If I do a paper for the West Coast Methods Institute, I'm going to, because they're focusing on insight, I'm going to find the instances in insight itself that support this position. I'm not really alone. Okay, let's break for 5 or 10 minutes.